You are listening to KRFC Fort Collins.
Her face is a map of the world, is a map of the world. You can see she's a beautiful girl, she's a beautiful girl. And everything around her is a silver pool of light. People who surround her feel the benefit of it, it makes you count. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. I'm Leslie, both of your hosts. It's 2 minutes after the hour, 6 o'clock here at the KRC studio. Welcome to all of you. I know we have new listeners joining us. Thank you to the listeners that join me every 2 weeks. And I want to thank all of the members out there, new and renewing members, for making our spring membership drive one of the best we've ever had. We raised $40,000. We are proud of that. That will help sustain us, and we could not do it without you showing appreciation for programs like this. Once again, you're listening to Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. I'm Leslie Botha, your host. Tonight we're going to continue a discussion that we had a couple of months ago on myalgic encephalomyelitis. Boy, I still can't say that. Tina, you're going to have to help me out. Myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, as we all know this. We're calling the show Advocates for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, Solving the Puzzle. It was a busy week in Washington, D.C. last week. First of all, May 12th was MECFS Day. We have two women joining us who are actually in Washington, D.C., advocating for those people who are suffering from MECFS. Also in Washington last week on May 10th, this was big. I mean, this was a big week in Washington, D.C. The Elizabeth Burt Center for Autism Law and Advocacy held a press conference on the steps of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, presenting the findings of a 2-year investigation of the vaccine court settlements paid out to families that had experienced vaccine injuries. The peer-reviewed study looked at cases of vaccine injury to families that have been monetarily compensated by the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or VICP. And what they found was that 21 cases specifically referenced autism or autism-like symptoms in court records. The researchers also identified and contacted another 150 more compensated families and found that 62 of those cases also had been related to autism, resulting in 83 cases in total, millions of dollars paid out by the federal government on autism-related cases after vaccine injury. This is the same federal government that is denying a link between childhood vaccinations and autism, yet behind closed doors, they are paying out millions of dollars in compensation for parents of injured children. The federal government has called autism a national health emergency, conservatively affecting 1 in 110 children. In Korea, it is now 1 in 38 children. And this is costing our country billions of dollars each year. And because almost all children in the U.S. are required by law to receive between 30 to 45 vaccines in order to attend public school, it is crucial that the VICP decide cases with justice and transparency. And the Elizabeth Burt Center for Autism Law and Advocacy is now calling on a federal investigation, calling on Congress to investigate the vaccine VICP program. So big news in Washington, D.C. Then again, as I mentioned, we had May 12th, which was MECFS Day in Washington. Those advocates also calling for studies and funding to get to the bottom of what is causing MECFS, a mystery disease, if you will, that is now afflicting over a million people in the United States, with more and more cases cropping up in pediatric arenas as well, affecting children. So tonight, joining me, advocates for CFS, Tina Tidmore is here. She was with us a couple of months ago. She is the Director of Communications and an Administrator for ME-CFS, Myalgic Encephalomyelitis, I almost had it, Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, Worldwide Patient Alliance. She's also became sick with ME-CFS symptoms since 2003, experienced a sudden plummet in her health in 2006, which led to a diagnosis. Also joining her is Kitty Loren. She's in her young 20s. She's had ME-CFS since puberty, showed signs after vaccine, but mild after a case of mono. She plummeted and is very disabled now. Her grandmother also has the illness. And I believe Susan Jackson is joining us, a mother who has ME-CFS. Both of her sons have it, too, and they all got sick within a couple of years of each other. No connections here to vaccine. She does not think there is one, but she sees it likely as genetic and infectious. In their case, and all of this coming up on Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. Tina, thank you so much for joining us and bringing Kitty and Susan. Is Susan with you tonight?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, very good. Tina, why don't you start off and please help me say this word right, and I feel so bad about it, but most importantly, let's go over again. What is ME-CFS?
Okay, you've actually done pretty good with it, Leslie. ME stands for myalgic encephalomyelitis, or also known as encephalopathy. It is a neurological disease that was given that name after an outbreak in a hospital in the in Britain, United Kingdom, and then in the 80s, there were two outbreaks that were reported to the CDC. That illness, which had the same symptoms as the myalgic encephalomyelitis, was given the name chronic fatigue syndrome. So now many studies will use both names, recognizing the illness is the same.
Okay, now my understanding is, and before I started talking with you, as a matter of fact, that this was an autoimmune disorder that primarily affected women in their older years, say 50, 60, endocrine systems are worn down, as well as some other disorders going on. But this isn't true, and it affects a much larger population than just women.
It truly does. Men can get this. In fact, anyone can get this at any time, of any age and of any gender, of any socioeconomic status. We have the problem of those that are not diagnosed. 1 million Americans, conservatively, we know, have this, but many, as much as 80 to 85% are not diagnosed. So we really don't know all the demographics of who have this illness. But from the outbreaks, we do know that it affects children. And we do have children that are now being diagnosed with this, as was the case in the outbreaks back in the 1980s. So it's becoming more known now that it is affecting people of many different ages, genders, race, and socioeconomic groups.
You know, I want to ask, but I think I'll table that. I was going to ask next what the symptoms are, but I think Kitty Lorenz is probably going to be able to give us a good picture of that. Again, Kitty, you're now 21, correct? You've had this, or in your young 20s, you've had ME-CFS since puberty, showing signs after a vaccination, but mild. But what happened? How do you feel? When I talked to you earlier, or just about an hour ago, I said, my God, you sound exhausted. But that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it is.
Do you want to tell us your story? What happened to you, Kitty?
Yeah. where do I start?
Exactly. Yeah, where do you start? We're not necessarily relating this to vaccines, but your health plummeted. You had a vaccination. Your health plummeted. It was an adverse reaction, obviously, but it was enough to upset your autoimmune system. And how did you start feeling?
The first thing that I noticed, it was just almost surreal. It was like a nightmare. And, you just knew that something that you'd never felt before, something you almost can't even describe, is happening to you. I mean, all of a sudden, the world, like, you're just looking, and nothing looks like, you have your normal vision every day that you're used to, and then all of a sudden, everything changes, and it's almost like you're walking through a dream or something, and your whole body just feels like feverish lead.
Okay.
And I still have that problem, like, every day. It's like you're walking through a nightmare, and it's painful.
It's painful, like, and nerves painful? Your nerve endings are painful, tingling?
I just had body aches everywhere, and, like, my lymph nodes are tender all the time, and I get fevers. And it's like muscle aches, and I have like spinal problems. My spine's very weak, and that hurts a lot.
We're going to talk about Washington, D.C. and your day in Washington, but you spent a whole day in Washington, D.C. last week. And someone might say, well, my gosh, he's able to do that, but there's a price to pay for that.
Oh, yes, definitely.
What happened to you on May 13th? You were advocating for congressional funding and help on May 12th. What happened to you on May 13th?
I totally crashed the next day. I couldn't even move out of bed. It was so painful, and I just felt like my body weighed a ton, and I could not even move. And you can hardly even think or anything. You just can't even move. You feel horrible.
So my understanding was that there was a hearing room or something where that you were all trying to sit in on a congressional hearing or something. Is that correct? Am I part of that correct?
It was like the Chronic Fatigue Advisory Committee meeting.
Okay.
That's correct.
And that there are actually cots laid out for...
Yes, there's cots.
Because,
some of us, we just crash. We can't...
You hold up that long.
...take it anymore.
Right.
It's just hard for us to even be there in the first place. Sometimes we're going to need to go crash, lay down.
Yep.
Because we can't take it anymore.
Right. All the stimulus on the body, I'd imagine, is pretty overwhelming for someone who is experiencing.
Yeah, and on the mind.
And on the mind.
Yeah.
Yep, that makes sense. Susan Jackson, let's bring you on next. You're a mother with ME/CFS. Both your sons have it, too. Your story is different. Did you have ME/CFS before your sons?
I did a couple of years before, but I was completely healthy for the first 37 years of my life. Very healthy, very active, physically fit. I loved to exercise. I had a very demanding career and traveled a lot. And then on March 1st, 2002, I suddenly became very ill. And this is the way it is for about 80% of the people who have ME/CFS. They can pinpoint an exact date when they got sick. And that's how it was for me as well. One day I was fine, and the next day I thought I probably had the flu. I had a very severe sore throat, achy all over, as Kitty was saying, and that feeling when you have the flu of just complete exhaustion, like your limbs are filled with cement and you can't move. You know, so I just assumed it was a virus.
That would pass.
And then right. You know, I let my husband take over, and I thought, okay, things will get better. And 3 weeks later, I was no better. I was still just as sick. And that's when I began to see doctors. I spent the next year going from one doctor to the next, seeing all kinds of specialists. I had hundreds of blood tests run, and no one could tell me what was wrong with me. After a year, I got lucky. By chance, I found a new primary care physician. My husband and I had been looking for a new family doctor anyway. And in that very first visit, she recognized that I had chronic fatigue syndrome. She had some other patients with it. I was very fortunate because there is not a lot of knowledge of ME/CFS within the medical community, and a lot of doctors don't recognize it.
Now, is it possible that because we're bombarding ourselves with so many environmental toxins, so much environmental stimulation, that our immune system is running down to a point that we may be more susceptible to unknown viruses that are coming into play?
Well, I think, you know, we're all exposed to all kinds of viruses all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just a fact of life. The difference here, and they have proven that there is a genetic predisposition to CFS, that certain people have the genetic makeup to be more prone to get it. So the current theories are that there's a genetic predisposition, and there are some research scientists in the UK who have identified the exact genes involved. And then if a person who has this genetic predisposition is exposed to certain triggers, which could be viruses, then they develop CFS. As an example, mono is a very common virus that I'm sure we're all familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people get mono. Most people, and it does sometimes last a month or two, but most people recover after that. Consistently, 10% of the population does not recover from mono and goes on to develop CFS. And it turns out that 10% mark is about the same for lots of other infectious triggers, Lyme disease, parvovirus, fever. So there are different infections that they have so far identified as triggers, though scientists still don't understand the exact mechanism.
And that's why you were in Washington. It is now 19 minutes after the hour of 6 o'clock here in Fort Collins, Colorado. You're listening to Holy Hormones, Honey, The Greatest Story Never Told. We're speaking with three young women, Tina Tidmore, Kitty Lorenz, in her young 20s, Suzanne Jackson, I'm assuming now, or Susan, that you are now in your 40s or early 40s. We're speaking about
45.
ME/CFS, most commonly known as chronic fatigue syndrome. You're raising lots of questions. Tina, you raised a huge red flag for me when you started talking at the top of the hour. I think Kitty and Susan hit on it as well. But Tina, you said nobody knows when you will get this. And nobody knows then why you're going to get this. And nobody knows why 10% of the population do not cover from mono or Lyme disease or various other diseases. Am I right about that, Tina? I mean, can it be really something that hit anybody at any time?
Yes, it can hit anybody at any time.
And that's...
It can come on gradually. For some people, it comes on gradually. For many, it comes on suddenly. And just... you're cooking supper one night, and you just have it like it comes over in a wave. That's it. You have to go to bed, and you're in bed, and that's it. For some, it's when they actually have a known virus, for example, mono, and then they end up just not getting better. That leads to what we now know as ME/CFS. And then for some, in the outbreaks, it's not tied to a known virus. It almost seems to occur as its own infectious occurrence. And some report that they think, this is anecdotal, that it is mold exposure that was their trigger. And some report that vaccines was a trigger. Some report that even funguses or other factors going on in their life were the trigger that put them into ME/CFS. So we don't know the cause. We do see that it runs in families, as you can see in the cases here that are talking to you today.
Mm-hmm.
It can also happen when you don't have any relatives with it, and it can happen in these varying onsets, gradual or sudden, tied to what seems to an infection or seemingly just on its own.
And disturbingly too, Tina, is that ME/CFS occurs in cluster outbreaks. And you even made note before we went on air that nurses now are contracting CFS, assuming they're contracting this through a hospital setting or a clinical setting. But talk to us about the cluster outbreaks.
Okay. Well, in the United States, there were two outbreaks or cluster cases that were reported to the CDC. One was in Incline Village, Nevada. In that case, it was a resort, affluent town, and you had physicians just suddenly, one person comes in with a seeming unknown virus, and they don't get better, and somebody else comes in, and somebody else comes in, and they had multiple cases there. The other outbreak of the United States that was reported to the CDC was in Lindenville, New York, which was a rural town of about 800 people, and a large number of those cases were pediatric. So we had two very divergent, again, demographics here. And this was in the mid-1980s. Of course, before that, in the 1950s, we had the case in the UK, which was in a hospital, all the way back to 1934, where we had a case in Los Angeles that was in a hospital. So we do see these clusters where people who have these connections to one another get it. And, of course, there are many others that were not reported to the CDC that are within the United States. And, yes, so if it happens in hospitals, then, yes, we do see that nurses do get it. And that is why May 12th was chosen as ME/CFS Awareness Day.
And that is, and you just told me this, is because May 12th was Florence Nightingale's birthday, and there is a reason for that.
Yes, because she also had an illness that was very debilitating and had symptoms that match what we now call ME/CFS. She was, of course, exposed to many things, and some think it was a chronic bacterial infection. However, we should note that chronic bacterial infections are part of ME/CFS. Chronic infections in general is part of ME/CFS. There's the immune system problem that makes it so that these viruses that everybody carries around with them that they got in their childhood become elevated. And so it ends up putting you in a chronic flu-like state depending on the person, for months, years. And so it is thought that Florence Nightingale could have had ME/CFS, and so that's why May 12th was chosen. And this year we have many activities going on tied to that recognition. A public service announcement we're putting out that shows the prevalence of ME/CFS. There was activities in Washington that Kitty and Sue participated in. There was lobbying. There was testimony. There's things happening on local levels across the United States, too.
All right, and we're going to get into all of that. Kitty, I want to go back to you, and I want our listeners to know that Kitty, and you can hear this in her voice, is really not feeling well tonight. So I want to get her on, and I did give her permission to leave the show early, and or not permission, but say that was fine if she felt she couldn't carry through the interview. Kitty, again, getting this CFS at puberty, and then you had mono, and then, boy, you went really downhill from there, correct?
Yes, yes.
And you are disabled now at 20, how old are you?
At 23.
And you're disabled at 23. What does that mean? Are you on disability?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm both by my doctor, and I had to go through court to get SSI. Both they have considered me disabled. And so there it is.
And there it is. You don't know when you're going to be feeling better. You don't know when you're going to be feeling worse. And every day is a...
It's like a total mystery of what's going to happen next.
But
you never know.
Right. And you can certainly, even if you have a good day, like Tina, it's a full moon. You said you were having a good day today. By tomorrow and after doing this radio show, it could be another whole can of worms for you.
Oh yeah. It's like, and almost, it's like good days are almost in a way bad, because you're like, oh, I feel great. I can go do all of this, and then you pay for it later.
Right. And Susan, and that's how you're feeling as well.
Oh yes, absolutely. One of the hallmarks of this illness is an intolerance to exercise or exertion. So, that means, you know, if we are having a good day and we go to the store or take a walk or something, we're very likely to feel worse the next day. Within a few hours to 24 hours after exertion, we suddenly feel like we've got a terrible flu again.
And so,
if I may jump in, Leslie, this has been shown biologically to be the case. There is a study that came out of Utah. It's commonly called the Light Study, where they actually had people come in and do exercise on one day. And they noticed that the people who have ME-CFS, and they tested compared to multiple sclerosis in healthy people, seemed to do very similar on that first day. But bring them all back the next day, and the ME-CFS people, their genes are putting out these proteins that just go off the chart. So it's that 24 hours later, 48 hours later, that you really see the difference. And this can also be shown in exercise tests when they're looking at blood volume or oxygen absorption. I'm sorry, not blood volume, heart rate and oxygen absorption. And they, again, bring them in one day. They've usually, you know, ME-CFS patients, they know they're going to come in. They've rested a couple of days. They come in. They do pretty good. But the next day, it's way different. And this is a difference between ME-CFS patients and people who are depressed. This is the difference between ME-CFS patients and those who have depression or have become deconditioned. So there's the difference. And that's why it's considered a hallmark symptom.
You're listening to Holy Hormones, Honey, The Greatest Story Never Told. I'm Leslie Botha, your host. It's just about 6:30 here in Fort Collins, Colorado, speaking on a very interesting subject that is now affecting more than 1 million people in the United States. I have a feeling when you all get done with your activities, there are going to be a lot more people coming out, just as we see now on the vaccine injury side of things, that people are starting to speak up and come out on this issue. And the great thing about all of this is that the people are speaking in Washington, D.C., and demanding compensation, transparency, demanding funding to try and find a cure for ME-CFS. Tina Tidmore is here. Kitty Lorenz is with us, and Susan Jackson. Susan, let's go back to you and just for just a moment, because I want to get into these pediatric cases. Your two sons are now diagnosed with ME-CFS. You think it's genetic and also infectious?
Well, yeah, that's been proven. There was a study in New Jersey in 2006 that looked at families, and they found that among people who had CFS, and I think there were about 200 some that they surveyed in New Jersey, 21% had at least one other family member who also had any CFS. And when they looked at the prevalence within households, they found an increased prevalence both for blood relatives, which proves the genetic connection, even if they didn't live in the same home, and also for people non-blood related but living in the same home, such as spouses. There's an increased risk for both groups. So, you know, that's how they know that it has both genetic and infectious roots.
So is there a virus here at play, Tina?
Well, certainly that is something that has always been a logical theory, considering the outbreaks. Also, we do have the possibility of a retrovirus, which is a virus that becomes part of the DNA when it enters the body and into the cells, and it becomes a part of the person. Since the outbreaks that happened in the 1980s, those physicians that were on the front lines there in Lindenville and in Incline Village said it looked like it was a retrovirus. And then there was a researcher out of the Wistar Institute, and she found a retrovirus higher in people who have ME/CFS. Now, that got some follow-up studies, but it did not get as much research as many patients wanted. And it was not declared to not be legitimate, although she had pictures of the virus, actually, and, you know, she had pictures of it. So then we have the Woodmore Peterson Institute that in 2009 has found a retrovirus that is named XMRV that they found in ME/CFS patients in a higher percentage, 67%. And this was followed up with a study by the National Institutes of Health and FDA, and they found relatives of that XMRV virus. They call them murine leukemia virus related viruses. They found different strains, and they found it in 87% of ME/CFS patients and in 7% of the blood donors that they tested. Now, since then, we've had studies that have said, no, what they're finding is actually something that's in a lab, and it's a contaminant. However, today there was a study that came out that showed that there is an immunological pattern in patients with XMRV that also have CFS. So the viral, particularly retroviral, cause has been a theory around ever since the outbreaks. Of course, genetics, what play that has.
Well, for heaven's sakes, if it's a genetic, I mean, if it's a retrovirus and gets into your DNA, then it makes sense that this would become an infectious and genetic disease as well that would be triggered by something else at any time in any person's life if they've been exposed to it. Is that correct?
That is one of the theories.
I've got Andy D is here, and he and I have become friends just recently, and he's offered to tech my show. And I mean, I'm going to bring him on air for just a moment because I'm sitting here, I'm listening to you three women. I am so impressed by what you know, the clarity, the depth of information, the research you have done. Andy, what are you thinking?
Well, I don't know a lot about it, to be honest with you,
yeah.
But it's very interesting. And it's
as to the women themselves, these were all career women, mothers.
Mm.
Kitty was off on a life as a teenager, and yet now their whole worlds are turned around, and now they have become researchers.
That's the only thing you could do. I mean, figure out things or what is going on. For anything like that to happen to anyone, I think that I would spend a lot of time researching myself and delving into the topic and finding out what is going on. Finding answers is one thing.
You know, we used to depend on our governments and our doctors to do this, but I mean, if these three women are an example and all the other hundreds of women I've interviewed over
the
years,
yeah.
What people are finding and bringing to their doctors and bringing to their legislators and bringing to the attention of the media. And that's exactly what the three of you are doing. Kitty, do you know?
Well, Leslie, if I may jump in here and explain what this is like. In a time of war, you have those that are on the front line who see the enemy and deal with the enemy day to day. They know the nature. They know the ways of the enemy. But someone who is a government analyst who just gets a report and is off in an office somewhere, he's not going to know the enemy as well as those that are on the front lines. Well, when we had the outbreaks, we had physicians who were there on the front lines, and we had the patients who were the victims. They saw the patterns with this illness. However, when you have someone who just researches things in microscopes, comes and just looks at charts, and then goes back, takes some blood, and then goes back and look at a microscope, he's not going to see the evidence that those that are on the front line see, the physicians who are dealing with it. And we're beginning to see a trend now at the meeting that happened in Washington where there was talk of going in reverse. Instead of researchers figuring out their theories and going and looking, of having the physicians, it's called reverse translational research, where we find out the physicians, what's working with the physicians, what patterns do the physicians see, and have that inform the research. So that's finally looking like that might happen with this illness. And that has been the missing, that's been the major obstacle to recognition and understanding the nature of this illness.
I think that was well said, very, very well said. Let's do get into, and Andy's agreeing here, let's do get into these pediatric cases. More and more children are coming up with ME/CFS. Susan, your two sons have it. Kitty, you have it. You have it as well into puberty. What's going on with our kids? And most importantly, and this is because we're going to run out of time here, even with 22 minutes to go, and most importantly, when your child says they don't feel well and they don't want to go to school, how do you know, determine whether they're just trying to get out of that math test or away from the bully, and they really are trying to voice that something is going on?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Leslie, because with our two sons, it was so obvious to us that something was seriously wrong. And I think it is obvious to most parents. However, what parents all over the world run into is doctors and school administrators who don't believe them. And this is a huge problem with children and teens who have ME/CFS. They call this an invisible illness for good reason. We look like normal people. You know, you can't tell, unless we're having a really bad day, in which case we don't leave the house, you can't really tell how sick we are just from seeing us. And particularly in young people, the illness very often is very up and down. You have good days and bad days. And I know with my kids, on their good days, they were perfectly normal. Now, if they did too much, they would, what we call crash, have one of those post-exertional crashes and feel horrible the next day, but then they'd be home and nobody would see them. So we dealt with a lot of, my husband and I had to really battle with school officials to get our kids the support that they needed. You know, our oldest son in fifth grade missed 60 days of school due to illness. And you know, they're the lucky ones. I know, personally, I know an awful lot of kids and teens who aren't able to attend school at all because they are so debilitated by this illness.
Kitty, was that your case as well?
Yeah. It got to the point where I was missing
over 100 days a year, like 150 days or something like that. And finally, it was just like, I can't even go anymore. And so I had to have a homebound tutor mm-hmm. for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And even because my school system, like she said, you know, you have a really hard time working with them and getting them to understand and be cooperative and whatnot. It didn't work out very well. I ended up having to drop out of school. Because it was just too much.
And
I worked so hard just to still fail.
Oh.
And Kitty's not the only one. That is not an uncommon story among kids and teens who have CFS. It's devastating.
Tina, you
mentioned... One reason is because of the neurological problems.
Right. I was going to ask...
not just the fatigue.
If there was brain fog here, you know, what might be interfering with that. But be that as it may, the bigger issue is here, Tina, and I want you to address it, that some parents are falsely accused of keeping their children at home, end up in social services, or being labeled Munchausen by proxy syndrome, overprotection of their child or making a big deal of their child's illness, you know, exemplifying it, demanding that their children need special needs. And is that true? I mean, are parents being falsely accused, like they're being falsely accused of shaken baby syndrome in some cases?
Well, we do know of cases where parents have been accused of having Munchausen by proxy or fictitious disorder by proxy, as it is called now. And this is, as Susan said, partly because the child may look well and may have good days, but also it's because children generally do not have the verbal skills yet to describe what they are feeling. They may use words like, I feel tired. And even then, many times, parents will not believe them. Well, you're just lazy. Get up. Go do something. And then...
I'm like my parents.
I was going to ask you, Kitty, is this sounding familiar to you?
Yeah, because even when once they knew what I had, they didn't understand it. You know, they didn't... And there's such a lack of information generally out there that is just like... That was definitely a big problem because I didn't understand what was going on with me. My parents didn't understand what's going on with me. And it becomes kind of an emotional thing because your parents are like, well, you're lazy. Come on, get up, do this, do that. And so what? You're like, I can't do that.
So, Kitty, what...
It feels bad.
At what age did it finally occur to your parents that they understood what was going on? How old were you at the time? That's my curiosity. Did it go on for a number of years before, or was it something that just came on rather quickly and it took them a while to figure this out?
Well, when I first got sick, you know, my parents totally didn't know what was going on. And my mom would talk to my grandma, who has it too. And that was how they started figuring out this might be what's going on with me, because my parents had no idea at all. And talking to my grandma, and she had it, and she's like, well, you know, this is sounding like this. This is sounding like she has CFS. And so we went to the doctor, and I had, you know, tests, eliminate this possibility, eliminate that possibility, and finally figured out that it was indeed CFS.
You know, I could see where... Go ahead, hon.
It still took... My parents still, like, once I had the diagnosis, they still didn't really understand what it meant. Okay, you have this illness, but what is it? What is it doing? I didn't even know exactly what was normal and what is caused by this disease. And then, you know, there's a lack of information
and awareness
that's out there for general public for awareness, and it causes problems big time.
I wonder how many people are actually wandering around having ups and downs and thinking it's depression, as Tina pointed out, or not feeling well, how many times we've sent our children to school. And I think your point was brilliant, Tina. They're not able to verbalize what they're feeling. Oh, I got lead. I feel like lead in my blood today, Mom. And we're saying, get out of the house, get in there. You got to go to school today. I've got to go to work. Dad's got to go to work. You got to go to school. What am I going to do with you all day? And forcing these children out of the house and just praying that they're going to finish school, knowing that they're going to get a phone call from the school nurse, right?
Well, sometimes that might be the case. The child might start off good, and then in the middle of the day, again, it's like somebody pulls a plug and it just drains out of them. That is often the case. One of the things that we know to be able to particularly identify this illness is that for a child who has been energetic, loved sports, involved in extracurricular activities, and then they get a case of mono or some viral type illness, and then from there on they don't recover, then that helps the parents to see a distinguishable change in their child's behavior. And so in those cases, it becomes easier to identify that. But the problem is that the physician may not have seen that difference. The physician is not going to see that as closely as the parent. And so, or maybe, you know, you take your child to another physician to try to figure out what's wrong. Well, that physician doesn't know your child at all. So we do have a case where a child was actually taken and put into foster care with the parents accused of medical neglect. And it took a rallying of many organizations to try to reunite this family. And that child was reunited, and through court with some expert testifying. And this was a case of a child who had ME/CFS. So this is an extreme case, but it just reflects the battle that many parents are dealing with, whether it's school officials or the physicians, to become advocates for their own child. Because they know the child better, and they can maybe see the cognitive problems. If you sit down with your child, and you go to do homework with your child, and they can't grasp things that have lists, they can't remember lists, or they can't remember the material that you just went over them with them the day before, then you see this is more than just a child not wanting to learn. This is a problem.
All right. Thank you. We've got about 12 minutes left, and we have to talk about the advocacy part of this. Six of you stood in Washington, D.C., in front of the Capitol on May 12th with just one sign, a 25-foot banner that read, Obama, Sebelius, HHS, standing for Health and Human Services. Shame on you for abandoning 1 million sick and disabled Americans with ME/CFS and XMRV, the newly discovered retrovirus. Clinical trials now. Are you telling me with 1 million people afflicted, known 1 million people afflicted, how many more that have not yet been diagnosed who may be suffering with this, that there are no clinical trials? What is being done?
Well, there has been one private company, and now I've heard of two, that have done clinical trials. But to my knowledge, there has not been any government-funded clinical trials. And maybe Sue, I don't know if Sue knows of any, but I am not aware of any.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, up until very recently, you just said two. I had only heard of one, so I'm assuming that's very recent. there's only been one drug company developing a drug specifically for CFS, and they've been trying to get it approved, I think, for over a decade now. Other than that, there is really nothing at all happening.
So until we have these clinical trials, until We have this awareness. There are people like you, Kitty, and you, Susan, wandering in and out of different doctor's offices until you may just hit one that goes, I know what you have. It's CFS.
Right. And actually, looking for a diagnosis for a year is a relatively short time for people with ME/CFS. Many people go 5, 10, even 15 years without knowing what's wrong with them. If we're talking about pediatric here, I started a local support group for families that have kids with CFS just in our local area. I started with 7 families, but I know very quickly I found out about at least 3 other teens that almost certainly have it but can't get a diagnosis. And they're very much stuck in the situation that you were just discussing with Kitty, where their parents don't know what's wrong, their doctors don't know what's wrong, but these kids are really suffering. So they not only don't have any treatments, they really don't even have a diagnosis.
So that's 10.
And there are no treatments yet. I mean, the only treatments we have are treatments aimed at easing particular symptoms.
Like pain.
Since we don't know the cause, there are no treatments yet that get at the root cause because we don't know what that is.
Sure, and then you're taking pain pills or antidepressants or anti-inflammatory drugs, excuse me, I'm just guessing on that last one, and they're further complicating things just how because of their chemical nature and interfering with what else the body is trying to do.
In some cases, some patients with ME/CFS have to take very low dose of these medications because their system itself is not working efficiently. So it becomes a choice. And so, the funding thing is just when you have $6 million spent on an illness that is costing the economy $18 to $23 billion in lost revenue, medical costs, which are of course great in this illness, going to doctor, having many specialists that you see. It just doesn't make sense, especially when you see that other illnesses get hundreds of millions of dollars and affect fewer people. It just what we're asking for is parity and research funding. We're not asking for anything to be taken away from others. We're asking for the impact of this illness to be recognized and given adequate funding.
Well,
it's just a matter of, stop the discrimination. And that's because, as we know, in cases of discrimination, it's based on ignorance most of the time. So with knowledge, and then with we can get the funding up to the levels that this illness requires. It's holding back the whole country, as a matter of fact. I mean, wouldn't it be great to have all these people paying taxes now?
And
yep,
that's exactly what we were in Washington to talk to our congressional representatives about last week. Everybody knows that the economy is bad and the government doesn't have any money. We're not asking for extra money. We're just asking for equity in the way medical research funds are distributed, because as Tina just described, right now it's far from equitable.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds very disturbing. I think you're all going to be doing a great job. I got to get some information, website for more information. We'll do that in just a moment. Susan, I have one more question for you. I have to go back to what you said. You started with a group of 7 families. You found out about 3 more teenage girls, so that's 10 families. You live in Texas, is that correct?
No, I live in Delaware.
You're in Delaware. Okay, I'm sorry. How big a community?
Delaware's a very small state.
Yeah, it is.
We're only 12 miles across at this point.
Right, so I'm just trying to get a perspective of 10 families out of a group of...
These are families. Yeah, some are right here in Delaware in the same county, in the same school district that we are. Some are just over the border into Pennsylvania or Maryland or New Jersey. We've got one family that's traveling a couple of hours from Long Island to come to meet up with our group simply because they couldn't find anyone nearby. So it's, you know, it's a pretty broad region. There are a lot, and this is the other thing that we were in Washington last week to drive home, the fact that there are many more children and teens affected by CFS than anyone currently understands. And there hasn't even been a population study yet to really get a good grip on what that number is.
Well, it's certainly
that
if it's
1 million
a retrovirus and it's in the DNA, I mean, that has incredible implications for generations
right,
to come.
Right. That 1 million number is only adults. Those population studies only include adults.
Oh, my God.
So that, you know, doesn't even begin to count the children and teens.
Well, we're going to have you all back. I mean, we're just getting to the tip of the iceberg on this thing. You are just all three brilliant women. Kitty, thank you so much for staying with us. I know these things are hard for all of you to do, to muster up the energy to share this type of information and on this level, for heaven's sakes, as well as a researcher. Tina, where's a website that people can go to get more information?
They can go to mcwpa.org, mcwpa.org.
And that will give you the latest information on ME-CFS, certainly contact information, and I hope, if anything, to our listeners, whether they're wherever you are listening, that you might share this information if you know of someone, anyone who is struggling in their life with good days and bad days and some of the symptoms that these three women are enduring. The rest, I think we need to advocate for more awareness in the schools for ME-CFS and certainly help parents and families that are struggling with this. I can't even imagine what you are all going through. Tina, give that website one more time, please.
mcwpa.org.
Thank you. Tina Tidmore, Susan Jackson, and Kitty Lorenz, thank you for joining us on Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. I support your courage, your advocacy, and if there's anything we can do as a community here in Fort Collins, let us know. Coming up in 2 weeks, June 6th, we're going to be talking about Premarin, HRT, hormone replacement therapy. Oh boy, here's another fiasco, people. Now drug makers are paying billions out to women who have contracted breast cancer from taking hormone replacement therapy. But we're not going to be talking about that. Pia Jansen from Wellington is going to be coming into the studio. She's an MSW. Her business is called Unbridled Equestrian Equine Assisted Coaching. And she uses Premarin horses in her equine coaching because it turns out that these mares are pretty traumatized by the time they give urine, horse urine, for Premarin hormone replacement therapy. So she uses traumatized horses, traumatized mares, in working with traumatized or abused people in her equine therapy practice. That's going to be a big one. June 6th coming up. I've been wanting to do a show on this for a while. And Pia Jansen from Wellington, her again business is called Unbridled Equine Assisted Coaching. You can find her on the internet. Will join us to talk about this whole Premarin HRT issue. Thank you to my guest tonight, and thanks to all of you for listening. Good night, everyone, and blessings.